Tasmania Talks with Mike O'Loughlin, weekday mornings from 9.
And a very warm welcome to Ruth Forrest, Independent MLC for Murchison. Ruth, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike. Nice to be back chatting to you.
It is indeed. Good to talk to you. Now, you're on King Island. I mean, beautiful spot, and if the weather's lovely, it's even better.
It's gorgeous weather, Mike. It's not a breath of wind and just clear skies, so it's lovely.
Tell me, you're up there for, I gather there's a public meeting tonight.
Yeah, Mike, I try and get over to the island relatively frequently as part of my electorate, and COVID, my visits have been far less regular than I would have liked. So it's great to be back for nearly 4 days. I've got a whole series of meetings arranged with a range of members of the community, and this evening we will have a public meeting where there's a number of island leaders, if you like, speaking at that forum, and I will be as well. And I'm really keen to hear from as many as I can about the things that matter most to them, predominantly the shipping issue, which has been an ongoing challenge.
Hasn't it ever?
Pretty much forever, because the island relies so much on an effective, affordable and reliable shipping service.
And you talk about cost of living. With King Island, of course, it's also the cost of shipping.
Well, the cost of living feeds directly from the cost of shipping, really, Mike, because we know, I mean, people know living on a remote island that everything has to be freighted in, either by sea or by air. And some things that are time sensitive do need to come by air. And all of those costs are added on to the product at on the shelf or in the shop, wherever it is. And that does add cost for people living on the island, and I think that's well acknowledged. The challenge has been that it's been very difficult to get breakdowns of freight components of certain elements of freight, including fuel, to actually understand why there is such a discrepancy between what you might pay in a regional area of Tasmania and what you'll pay on King Island. So, and it's been very difficult to get answers out of government in relation to the various components of the freight task, which has been entirely frustrating. And quite unfortunate, in my view.
Yeah, I can't agree more. It just must be so, so difficult when all they want to do is just get the stuff over there and just get it. Anyway, it's ongoing. I'm glad. I'd love to know the outcome of some of that, some of those meeting agendas that is on this evening. Love to know more. Tell me, I mean, coming from the health industry yourself, you must notice the pressure, and you've even said the pressure on all areas, and it's just getting to just an awful situation in this state, isn't it?
Well, it is, Mike, and I don't think we're unique in the world or certainly in the country in this. But I think I was actually speaking to someone just the other day, and they said, well, if you could do one thing, what would you do? And I think, I mean, part of my role in chairing the committee that looked into rural health has informed these comments, but generally, we all know, I think, Mike, if we can keep people well and out of our acute health service, then we'll actually take a whole heap of burden off the acute service. It doesn't mean people won't need it. People still will. People will get acutely unwell quickly sometimes. They'll have accidents or things like that that require urgent attention. And obviously, you can't deal with a heart attack in a general practice surgery. So there are things that will always need acute care. But the problem is with the primary health, the preventive health space, where it's keeping people well in the community, looking after their chronic illnesses that people inevitably get, that if we can keep people well, they won't deteriorate to the point of needing hospital care as often. And we can actually prevent that demand increasing. So there's a whole range of things we need to do, but we do need to ensure that the federal government adequately fund the primary health services, the services that are provided by GPs in our community. Some of them are provided by the state, but predominantly this is a federal government responsibility, and we really need greater investment in that area.
Look, I totally, totally agree. I recently had surgery myself, and waiting a while for to get got in surgery, and just to see how busy it was, but the amazing and wonderful care given by the staff, all staff, doesn't matter whether admin to nurses, to doctors, to anaesthetists, all of that sort of stuff, was absolutely incredible. And yet they maintain that day in, day out for just an incredible amount of hours. They're amazing people.
Yeah, we universally hear that, Mike. A Occasionally there'll be a complaint about the health service and system, and often that comes back to an issue of communication in a lot of the cases. But what most people, by and large, the vast majority, always acknowledge and commend the medical and nursing and allied health staff that provide that care. Mm. They do. They turn up every day. They turn up when they're really tired. They turn up to back up, to help their colleagues when someone's called in sick. They do the work that a lot of us wouldn't particularly want to do to help keep us well and to get us better and out of hospital. So I do thank them all. It's often a thankless task, even though we do thank them, you know, when people do acknowledge it. So, yeah, they do. They just turn up. As a former health professional, I know how it works. And I just admire the ongoing commitment, particularly during and as we continue to deal with the COVID pandemic.
Absolutely amazing. And speaking of COVID, the restrictions, how do you feel about the COVID restrictions being eased now? Pretty much, I mean, let's face it, everyone in the state is pretty well acting, and well, in the country, is acting like it doesn't exist anymore.
I know, which is a bit of a concern, Mike, because it is still there, it is still real, and people are still dying from it. And we know that vaccination provides a great deal of cover, and we're seeing far less deaths than we would have. But the reality is, Mike, that it's still there. It still kills more people than the flu, for example. Mm. And the flu can be a deadly virus, particularly for vulnerable and older people. Much like COVID is much more deadly, if you like, for vulnerable, immunocompromised, people with a disability, older people. We know who the people are who are most at risk. To me, the decision to remove the quarantine period, if you like, or the time you need to stay home and not go to work when you actually have COVID, is an economic, not a health decision. We know that the federal government had said not long ago that as a state or as a country, we should still keep paying people pandemic leave if we were requiring them to stay at home. So this will now mean that there's casual workers who don't have access to sick leave will just end up having to go back to work because they won't be paid, they won't have any income, and then we'll inevitably see an increase in the number of cases. And I mean, I was talking to some people from the disability sector, people with a disability just, I think it was 2 days ago, and they were very concerned about this. They feel like they're being left behind all the time and not even part of the conversation. So I still urge people, whether particularly those who are feeling vulnerable or have vulnerable family members, to do what they can to protect themselves. Don't go to work if you're sick. Hopefully, if you've got full-time or part-time employment where you can get sick leave, take your sick leave. It's very difficult for casual workers. And wear a mask where you can't socially distance or you can't keep apart from people. That's a personal choice now, we know that. But I think if some people do it, it makes it easier for others too. So,
and people still are wearing masks. You can see that as you're travelling around the place, which is good news to see that those people are doing that. And I know even my little passage through the hospital system, by the way, I've got quite a few more passages to come. But, I mean, the reality is the way they treat you through there, of course, is they're very COVID aware in every facet. So, I mean, it's still around.
Well, they're dealing with vulnerable people, the patients there, because they're unwell and often their immune systems aren't as able to fight off infections should they get it. So the health professionals know what's right, and will continue to do that. It's just a shame that I think the decision, the way I see it, the decision is more about economics than about health.
And it's not just economics. I think it's not so sexy anymore to talk about it, is it really? And, you know, politics like to be on the upside, not the downside.
Well, it's tiring, Mike. It's been going on for so long, and I think people get tired of it. But, you know, it doesn't mean it goes away because you stop talking about it.
Tell me about if we move on, Holmes-Taz bill. That's passed. I was talking with Mark Cattani, Vinny State President, just a little while back, very supportive of the fact that the Holmes-Taz bill has passed.
I mean, there are mixed views on this bill, Mike. Oh, I did support the bill. I did listen quite carefully to the housing providers like Colony 47, Evolve Housing, which is the Catholic organisation that provide housing through Centre Care, and other service providers who provide services not just in terms of housing but also to people who are homeless. and people who are from struggling financially or in other ways. And they clearly see the very real demand. They see the gaps. They see the failure of the of governments past and present to actually keep ahead of the need for housing, particularly social or public housing. And whilst they weren't perhaps glowing in their praise for us, they knew that what we were doing now is simply not working. Mm. And I know the key to it is building more homes, not just homes for people who need social housing, but homes for people generally. Our population's increasing. One of the key problems with getting workers to our regions is the lack of housing. And so it means building housing for workers, building houses for or homes for people who are moving to the state. So the more homes that are built, the less pressure there will be on the public housing sector. So to me, this develops a statutory authority to oversee all of this and to take a bigger picture, to take a more strategic view. And to ensure that money can be made available through borrowing against the assets that you own or and supporting some of these other housing organisations to actually continue to build more homes. So without something like this, it will be difficult to get the number of houses built in a timely manner. We're seeing far too many people homeless in our state, and it's not okay by any measure.
No, not at all.
It won't fix the problems overnight, Mike, and it won't address all these issues in a really timely manner, I'm sure, for many, many people. But I think it is the right thing to do to get started on getting homes on the ground and people into them as quickly as we can and to provide the services to support them. And this is, as I understand the bill, it was also to ensure that support services for homelessness and people in social and public housing are part of this arrangement. It's no good just putting someone in the house and saying, oh, tick, we fixed you. You've got to make sure they can access the services they need to stay in that home. And that's really important. So,
absolutely.
Hopefully we'll see this actually make a real difference for people in their lives.
Speaking with Ruth Forrest, independent MLC for Murchison. Ruth, you would have been a bit gobsmacked when you saw how much people are spending on the pokies, $17 million pretty well a month.
$300,000 a week, wasn't it, or something?
Yeah, crazy.
Wait a minute. But anyway, it's a terrible... I haven't got the figures in front of me, Mike, but it just reminds us how much money is being lost through the poker machines. And it doesn't go back to the people of Tasmania in great numbers. It goes to the pokies owners and operators. And some of it, yes, goes back to the government through taxes. But the tax arrangement that the government brought in was an absolute free kick for the industry. So well, we could have actually clawed back a lot of that money and put it back into our communities, the government chose not to do it, supported by the Labor Party, which was really disappointing. So what we're seeing is ongoing significant losses out of money out of our communities into the pockets of a few. And the enormous harm that brings. I was mortified to read the number of machines per population on the West Coast. For every 61 people on the West Coast, there is one machine. It's frightening.
It's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
I know. And, I mean, the number of areas in my electorate, like the West Coast, we've got Burnie and even Devonport, which is not my electorate, but just along the coast. We've got some of the highest use and losses in the state. And it's really very concerning. Waratah, Winyab was right up there as well.
You're looking...
has real impact on real families.
What about the card system they're trying to bring in?
Yeah, Mike, I absolutely commend the government for agreeing to do that. Many people in the sector were surprised they had the courage to do this. It is a courageous move. It will be the first in the country to have a pre-commitment card of this nature. Sadly, it doesn't come in until, I think it's 2023 or 24. I can't remember the exact date for that. But I do understand there has to be modifications to the machines and that for that to occur. I know there's been enormous pushback from the THA, the Hospitality Association, and the sector that represent the pokies effectively, which I think is quite smacking of hypocrisy, really, because they've always said They don't make their money from problem gamblers. It's the recreational gamblers they want. Well, recreational gamblers will not be impacted by the introduction of a pre-commitment card. People who don't have a problem and can go and can prove that they don't have a problem in terms of they've got they can afford to lose more money than the pre-commitment card would allow, can get their limit increased. So the only people who really suffer here are the people who are addicted to the pokies, who and the machines are, by their nature, designed to be addictive.
Yeah, they are indeed. Tell me, I'd love to have some follow-up on the Tasmanian Anti-Discrimination Commissioner's report into workplace culture in the Tasmanian Ministerial and Parliamentary Services, the bullying, because I when I was researching it, there was a story, you even got bullied.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I think there was a well-publicised event some years ago, but this report's not about me. It's about the culture of the Ministerial and Parliamentary Services in our Parliament. And sadly, it's much like many other reports that have been done in parliaments around the country and many other big organisations. So I think we all need to be very aware of this. There's a number of recommendations made by the Anti-Discrimination Commissioner, and one of them included the establishment of a committee to oversee the adoption of the recommendations. It's not actually to adopt the recommendations, it's to oversee that. Another really important recommendation was the appointment of an independent project officer type role to undertake the work of actually delivering on the recommendations. So that committee has been established. It has been has met, and the committee will be getting on with making sure that appointment is made of that person to undertake that really important work. I'm on the committee, Mike. The others include the Premier and Leader of the Opposition, the two presiding officers, the Speaker and the President, Leader of the Government in our House, Sarah Lovell, and Cassie O'Connor from the lower house. So it's an eight-person joint house committee, and I think we just need to get on with that work of making sure and overseeing the delivery of the recommendations to make it a safe workplace for everyone.
And Ruth, tell me about the government's anti-protest legislation. I mean, that was watered down after the chat through the Legislative Council. Are you happy with it?
Oh, I did support in the end, Mike. I did an awful lot of work. I wouldn't call it watering down. I would call it focusing the effect. I absolutely and fundamentally support the right to protest. I think that there's been times I've protested myself. There'll be times in the future, no doubt, I'll wish to. And everyone should be able to protest in a way that doesn't hurt or harm other people. The government stated intent was to strengthen the trespass laws where someone was actually actively and deliberately stopping someone go to work through their trespass action. The bill was much, much broader than that when it came in, and I couldn't support it the way it was. It really did threaten that right to protest on public roads and streets and more broadly. So I successfully amended the bill to make sure that the people who will be caught up in this, if you like, are people who are actively trespassing. If you trespass now, you can get a fine and a potential jail term. This adds in effectively an aggravated trespass clause, so that if you're already trespassing, which might mean you're on someone's land or on someone's vehicle or in someone's vehicle or in their building, in a private building like a factory or something. If you are doing that and you actively and intentionally prevent someone from going about their lawful work, then you can get a higher penalty and a longer jail term potentially. That's up for the court to decide. And I also put an exemption, if you like, for people who are workers demonstrating, like taking industrial action in their own workplace, because by the nature of that work, often you will obstruct the business and prevent some people getting to work. Mostly that action doesn't involve that, but it just meant that they wouldn't suffer the higher penalty if they were trying to raise matters of concern around the safety and welfare of their workforce or the people they were caring for, like nurses, for example.
When does it come into fruition, if you will?
Fairly soon, I think, Mike. I'm not exactly sure whether it's had royal assent yet. We sort of deal with it in our house and it goes to the governor for sign-off. And I think that's actually occurred, but I'm not sure the data was actually to commence. So if it's not in place now, it would be fairly soon, I imagine.
And just to finish off, I'd love your opinion. I know that Prime Minister Albanese and senior cabinet ministers, I mean, everybody could be subject to phone taps and surveillance by the new proposed National Anti-Corruption Body if things are deemed necessary by its chief commissioner. I mean, it contains only very limited exceptions, doesn't it, from the commission's jurisdiction, for example, for members of the judiciary to reflect their constitutional separation of powers, if you will. But it certainly is a very strong bill, the NAC bill, isn't it?
It certainly is. I mean, I haven't looked at all the detail yet, Mike, and because I know it is going to a parliamentary committee for further consideration before it's actually debated in the parliament. But I do commend the government and all parties, particularly for working really hard on this, and that includes Helen Haynes, who's done an enormous amount of work on this. And there's been many others, a lot of the other independent members, and Bridget Archer.
Independent for
So there's been a whole range of people who've been very active in this space. I mean, I think generally the statement that if you do nothing wrong, you've got nothing to worry about should prevail here. But I think it will actually make people in positions such as in politics generally and in the bureaucracy and in senior positions there to actually think about what they're doing and to ask themselves the question, is this the right thing to do? Have I got a conflict? Because if you're not doing that as a matter of course, then you could end up inadvertently potentially doing something that's inappropriate. But where you step over into corrupt behaviour, I mean, a lot of people talk about corrupt behaviour and in a very broad brush, but I'm talking about seriously corrupt behaviour, then that is simply not okay. And no one, I think, would ever accept that to be okay. Mm. So I think it'll force people, all members of parliament and those that around them, to ensure that they ask themselves those questions, and which we should be doing anyway. We shouldn't need this bill to do that. But it'll actually really help to focus the attention, I'm sure.
And there'll be a lot more on that to the National Anti-Corruption Bill. Mm. Ruth, good to talk to you again. I really appreciate our chat. Ruth Forrest, independent MLC for Murchison. I look forward to our next chat.
Thanks, Mark. It's always a pleasure to chat to you.
And indeed, all of that will be on our website coming up to later on this afternoon. Ruth Forrest here with Tasmania Talks.
Tasmania Talks with Mike O'Loughlin, weekday mornings from 9.